Welcome to the Summer of Peace, a free global online event designed to help you find inner peace and to take inspired action. The Summer of Peace is a production of the Shift Network, and this Global Compassion Summit is co-produced with Stanford University's Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, as well as the Charter for Compassion. The Global Compassion Summit highlights the latest science and practices that help us embrace compassion and recognize compassionate action as an important path to peace. We're so grateful that you're here. Please share your questions or insights at www.facebook.com/shiftnetwork. And now, your host for this call, Emily Hine, the director of the Global Compassion Summit.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for dedicating some of your time to compassion today. My name is Emily Hine, and it's my honor to be your host for the Global Compassion Summit. I've been very eager to share the incredible wisdom and commitment of our next guest with you since this summit was really just a seed of an idea. Karen Armstrong is a religious historian, former nun, and the author of numerous books that I'm sure you've heard about, including The Case for God, 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life, and Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence. Her work has been translated into over 50 languages. She has addressed the U.S. Congress on several occasions, the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington and New York, and is an ambassador for the U.N. Alliance of Civilizations. Something noteworthy to know is that in 2007, Dr. Armstrong received a medal from the Egyptian government for her services to Islam. She was the first foreigner to have been awarded this decoration. She's received numerous additional awards that you can read about in her bio. What we really want to focus on today is how Karen became such a pivotal leader in the compassion movement. In 2008, Karen Armstrong was awarded the TED Prize for her vision of a charter for compassion, which was crafted by leading thinkers in six of the world's major religions as a cooperative effort to restore not only compassionate thinking, but more importantly, compassionate action to the center of moral and political life. She's the founder of the Charter for Compassion International, which is one of the lead co-sponsors for this Global Compassion Summit. Karen Armstrong, we are incredibly honored to have you here with us today. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
We are thrilled for the title of this session, which is How the Compassion Movement Can Improve and Gain Momentum. This is a deep and relevant topic to so many of us who've been involved in the movement really since it began. So let's get started. First, Karen, would you please bring the listeners up to speed with a short recap about what happened when you won the TED Prize in 2008?
Well, at that time, TED gave prizes every year to individuals whom they think have made a difference in the world, but with their help could make more of an impact. And they gave you some money, $100,000 was the prize money, and they also give you a wish for a better world that TED would promise to make happen. And so I knew immediately what I wanted, because as a historian of religion, all my work, whatever topic I was studying or researching, inevitably drew me to the notion of compassion, and which lies at the heart of all spiritual, moral, and ethical religions. The golden rule has been formulated by every single one of the major faiths quite independently, and it's said to be the hallmark of true spirituality, the test of true faith. Never treat others as you would not like to be treated yourself. They also insisted that you could not confine this benevolence to your own group. You must have what one of the Chinese sages called Yan Ai, concern for everybody. Love your enemies, said Jesus. And so I had come to the conclusion that now, in our very polarized world, unless we learn to implement the golden rule globally so that we ensure that all peoples, whoever they are treated as we would wish to be treated ourselves, the world is simply not going to be a viable place. So as you said, I asked TED to help me craft, create, and propagate this Charter for Compassion. And it was written, composed by leading thinkers and activists representing six of the major world faiths. It was a declaration that on this, at a time when the religious religions are all often seen to be at loggerheads, on this we were all in agreement and that we could work together for a better world. And it was also a call to action, because compassion's not just a warm glow in the heart. It has to express itself practically. And from this, by various fits and starts, it had a long and checkered and uneven history. A Charter for Compassion International came into being. So we move on.
Wonderful. Thank you for the recap. And one of the beautiful elements of the Charter and what you've just expressed is that compassion needs to express itself practically. And the Charter for Compassion has been a great vehicle for doing exactly that. Could you talk a little bit about what is working with the Charter for Compassion? I know it's now being implemented in creative ways in countries and cities and schools and businesses throughout the world. Could you give a few examples of where cities have embraced the Charter?
Our most recent city is Karachi in Pakistan, right on the heart of so many of the troubles that are tearing our world apart so dangerously at the moment. And in fact, Pakistan, in my view, is so far the star of the Charter. A young businessman there has created a network of schools of compassion which incorporates compassionate teaching practically into core subjects of the curriculum in order to train the leaders of tomorrow. There are now 25 of these schools, and it was the children who made the plea for the city to be more compassionate. And they are going to extend their activities, Compassionate Karachi, into business, professional life, and even in driving, which I can tell you, as one of my many visits to Pakistan, needs improving. Washington, D.C., Imam Muhammad Majid, who is president of the largest Muslim organization in North America, has made ISNA affirmed the charter. He has started in his own center a healthcare clinic that offers free healthcare to anybody who wants to come in his huge center near Dallas Airport. They've got a youth movement going now. They're training ambassadors of compassion and encouraging all ISNA mosques to put the charter up prominently in their mosque in Arabic. And also to include compassion in the training of imams. It's an immensely important work. And quite recently, too, this year, earlier, I was in Jordan, and Amman became a compassionate city. There again, right, Amman, Jordan is so situated, inundated at the moment with refugees from the various troubles of the last 10 years or more, for many of those years received no government funding, and it's got Israel on one side, Iraq on the other, really another beacon of hope in a dangerous place. And I'm working there particularly with one of the princesses who has started a wonderful institute for improving the media in the Middle East. She herself had a career in CNN before her marriage, and she's now making this school a center for excellence in media, all kinds of media, because media is playing such a crucial role in the polarization we're experiencing in the moment in both the West and the Muslim world. We see each other in very black and white terms. So a compassionate media is hugely important. We're thinking of hosting annually in Amman an international conference on compassion in the media.
Oh, beautiful. And so these elements that you speak of, Karen, these are all elements that have come out of the effort from the Charter for Compassion. Is that correct?
Yes, indeed. People have been inspired by the Charter and want to put it into action, because I think a lot of people feel that the time has come for this. I mean, we're inundated with such terrible news day by day, and we see such terrible suffering through the world. And I really believe that we are on a very dangerous course, that the world won't be a safe place to hand to the next generation unless we somehow overcome the huge global disparity in wealth and power. And so when I see these people working in places like Pakistan, right, in such difficult circumstances, in Karachi they suffer suicide attacks nearly every day. The Pakistanis too are suffering hugely from drone attacks. And yet still they have this passion for compassion, and that is a sign of hope.
It really is heartwarming to see the resilience of the human spirit, and the Charter for Compassion gives people a tool, if you will, to hang on to and to bring into life in ways that are relevant to their respective city. Let's kind of go up to the higher level for a moment here and look at the 40,000-foot view of compassion and the movement. Most successful social movements have both this grassroots component as well as the endorsement of major leaders. And this movement seems to have both. So we see it, but regardless, do you think the momentum has slowed down a bit? And if so, why do you think that might be?
There are several things I think we can improve upon. Number one, I think we want to bring a bit of more rigor into the compassion movement. Rigor, not in a sense of being sort of strict but a sense of disciplined thought, and make our institutions a bit more institutionally viable and financially viable. I think this really needs to be done. One of the things we're doing is in England, we're in the process of creating a university department, a university institute that will focus on the academic study of compassion in such matters as healthcare, education, environmental concerns, and transcultural understanding. And that will sort of, because there is sometimes when people talk about compassion, they talk a lot about love and tenderheartedness and getting on nicely with one another. But I think we need really to see what are the difficulties involved, what compassion actually means. Compassion is not about sentiment, and that's a kind of an observation I've had to make over and over again from the very beginning. The word has so fallen out of our lexicon people seem to equate it with pity. I was in Holland some years back, and I specifically said that compassion did not mean feeling sorry for people. But in the Dutch translation of my text the next day in the newspaper, every time I said compassion, they used the word pity. Compassion requires you, or as Confucius said, all day and every day, not just when you feel like it, to look into your own heart, discover what gives you pain, and then refuse under any circumstance whatsoever to inflict that pain on anybody else. Never impose on others what you yourself do not desire, said Confucius. And for Confucius, that was a practical, political necessity, not just something for one's personal life. Because the Chinese sages said, unless human beings learn that they must treat other states as equal to their own state or kingdom, human beings will destroy one another. And that's never been more true than it is today. So I think a bit more discipline, rigor, a little less emphasis. I would hate that if the movement became some kind of therapy for people. It's nothing wrong with that, but I think we've got some urgent jobs to do. And especially what I'd like is to encourage people to adopt a more global outlook. This is hard for us because the nation state encourages us to focus on our own nation or our own city, but we have created a global market now where we cannot exist or prosper without one another. Financial institutions all across the world are so tightly interdependent that when markets fall in one part of the world, stocks plummet all around the globe that day. We share the same environmental catastrophe. We're politically bound together. What happens now in Pakistan or Afghanistan can have repercussions tomorrow in New York or London. And yet our perceptions often haven't caught up with the reality of our situation. So, I mean, my dream has always been from the very first when we started the Cities Campaign that these international reach of cities, and there are now 200 of them more going through the process of declaring themselves compassionate cities, should form a tight network, a firm network, to sort of counterbalance the polarization of our world into such warring, terrifying camps. And my dream was to twin some of these cities so that, for example, a city in the United States could be twinned with a city in Pakistan or the Middle East. Now, people are very keen for that to happen in the Middle East. I know in Amman, it said, oh, we want to twin with Seattle because we have a lot of things in common with Seattle that we can work together. My idea is that mayors could have conferences, compassionate mayors, global conferences where they could talk together about common difficulties. We could encourage the young in these compassionate cities to have form electronic friendships with people in their sister city. And gradually some of these misapprehensions we have about one another could be whittled away. So I think the whole idea of a little more institutional and intellectual rigor, discipline to the movement, plus a more global outlook is what's required to take it that step forward and really make it meet the troubles that we're facing today.
I think that's beautifully said, and I appreciate the high-level view that you bring to this. I'm thinking about it from the grassroots perspective. Karen, do you think that we're missing specific demographics, for example, the younger population, or are there specific kind of target markets, if you will, that have not fully engaged in the charter? Have you been able to witness any of that?
I don't know. You see, I think a lot of young people in schools and colleges are quite keen on it, as well as the elderly. I don't think it's demographic so much. We've got loads of people doing the charter. I think we just need to do it well now, better, rather than just spreading the idea. People were always in the early days sending me around the world to talk about compassion. And eventually I got wary of this because nothing happened. You know, I'd go and everyone would speak and everyone would have a good cry. And then I'd go home and nothing happened. You know, we need to focus on action. And I think we can encourage people in their daily practice to include this global awareness. You see, we are inundated today with more images of suffering and pain than any previous generation. We have images sort of beamed into our homes every night on the news. Right now in Europe, we are seeing these tragic number of migrants who are coming from places like Syria and North Africa and even sub-Saharan Africa. Some of them even crossed the Sahara, taking 1.5 years to do so in order to break into Britain and European countries. And many of them are just put to sea in these dreadful boats by unscrupulous people and just left to drift. And many, many people have died. But it shows this terrible, terrible image of a suffering world looking at the safe little enclave that we have in our Western countries, this enclave of privilege. I'm always reminded of the Buddha's pleasure park here. You know the story about the Buddha when he was a young man and he was his father invited various priests to come and tell the little boy's fortune when he was just a little baby. And one of these priests predicted that he would become a Buddha because he would see four very upsetting sights that would compel him to leave home and become a monk and find a cure to help people live with their pain. And the Buddha's father didn't think much of that career option for his son, so he shut him in to a pleasure park and posted guards all around the gates, all around the grounds, to keep any upsetting sight at bay. And eventually the gods took a hand and sent four gods past the guards, disguised as a sick man, an old man, a corpse, and a monk. And the Buddha was so horrified by these sights of pain and suffering that he left home that night. Now, the image of the pleasure park surrounded by guards is, I think, a wonderful image of the mind in denial, because Buddhism is a very psychological religion. And we are very reluctant, we don't want to see pain. We want to keep it at bay, keep it away from us, keep it away from our family, from our city, from our nation. But it's a futile exercise, as that myth tells us. Suffering always will break in the end. And this image I see of these people in their pathetic little boats coming in shoals, thousands, to try to break into our little enclave, our pleasure park, privileged pleasure park of Europe, is one symbol of this. Another instance is the number of sights we see on our television coming now from the Middle East with the whole ISIS crisis, the suffering of these refugees, the people who died and are frightened and are being killed. We should let these images upset us. A good sort of practice, meditative practice, would be to just pick on one of those faces. Perhaps it's a child dying of because of lack of proper water in Africa, or a refugee, and just focus on that face and remember it at various points during the day, and let it unsettle us. Because the Buddhist tradition, karuna does not mean anything to do with sentiment when they talk about compassion. Compassion, or karuna, means to take responsibility for the pain of the world and do everything in your power to find practical ways of assuaging it. And the first step is to be as upset as the Buddha was when he saw those four disturbing sights. And it's the realization that life is full of suffering, and however privileged a life we have, and however deserving we may feel of our privilege, we must never forget that the others are our brothers and sisters.
Beautiful. Thank you for expressing that. I wanted to bring back into focus the role of compassion education as well in this movement, because what you've said very beautifully is, you know, we are in the West kind of absorbed in this pleasure park, and it's very easy to keep the mind in denial when we have so many wonderful distractions. And we don't want to see the pain. What I have found from the compassion training that I've been privileged to take through the Stanford C-Care program, and that I've been exposed to with mindful self-compassion and compassion-based, compassion-focused therapy, Paul Gilbert's work, and there's so many beautiful compassion education programs that actually help us learn how to be with our suffering so that we can be with the suffering of others, right? And then we can move from a place of perhaps distress, empathetic distress, into a place of action. Can you speak to the role of compassion education in the charter and how you see that playing a role moving forward?
Well, I take a different line. I mean, I know these projects and I think they're wonderful, but I have, because my writing, it takes me in a different direction. And I think we've got to educate ourselves and our young about come back again to other parts of the world. I think we are hopelessly ignorant about other parts of the world, and also the fact that we are deep, you know, this isn't just their suffering in the Middle East. It's we are involved in this. That came home to me very clearly when I went to Israel for the first time to make a television program on St. Paul in 1982. And I was working with an Israeli film company in Jerusalem. And I knew nothing really about the Middle East conflict, but soon, when you're actually there, you're engaged by both sides, by both Palestinians and Israelis. And I was struck forcibly by the fact that neither of them, neither the Palestinians nor the Israelis, had one good word to say about the British and their role in this way back at the beginning of the century, of the 20th century. And I realized this is not just their problem. We are here too. It's a threefold history. And we've got to become aware of how our governments have often helped to create the mess that we're seeing in the Middle East at the moment, just to name one example. And Israel and India, Pakistan, another sort of great horror committed by the British Empire. So in the division of India, into two countries in which 1 million people lost their lives at the time of partition and 7 million were displaced. And this has left scars and pain. So at the same time as we're working on ourselves to have self-empathy and all, and this is important. We have, I did a 12-step program, and 12 steps to a compassionate life, a little book. And step three is compassion for yourself. Steps 9, 10, 11, and 12 are all about going global. You can't just wait until you've finally achieved self-empathy and are now sort of wonderfully sort of attuned to the compassionate ethos. Because we haven't got time. We've got continually to reach out and start extending our horizons. So I'd like to see much more education in the other people's history, other people's religious beliefs, and the entanglement of our nations with one another and how we are together implicated in the sorrows of our time.
Wonderful. I want to reiterate the book, 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life. It's received incredible reviews. So if somebody's listening to this call today and want to know a good place to start, I would highly recommend Karen's book, The 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life. So let's go back very quickly. We have just a few more minutes left. To the Charter for Compassion, we have this great opportunity to reach a lot of people. Please tell us, how can we support the work of the Charter? How can people get involved in their own communities? What are the most important steps in supporting the Charter at this time?
One thing to do is to go to the website. If your city is not one of these cities going through the process of becoming a compassionate city, there's a kit on the website that tells you how to go about doing this. Or perhaps you'd like to make your community, your particular community, a compassionate community, compassionate school, or a compassionate church, or a compassionate mosque or synagogue. These are all things that, you know, that you can do. I think just keep an eye out on what's going on, but let it spill over into action. Step two is to say, first step one in my, the 12-step program is about learning about compassion in your own traditions and other people's traditions. Step two is about looking at your own world. Look around your own world. Look around your family and see what you personally can do to make your family a happier, more wholesome, healthy, productive, a compassionate family. Then look around your place of work and see what you personally can practically do all day and every day to make that workplace a happier place, or how you could influence your profession, for example, to become more compassionate. And then your city, think about your city and how that could be a more compassionate place. I call this, my book, 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life, because I was obviously harking on the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did this quite deliberately, because this is a process that lasts your whole life long. This is not a sort of how-to business, so that in, like you have in 6 weeks, you'll lose so many pounds of weight. This is a process that will last a lifetime, because we'll never arrive at total compassion. We have to struggle day by day with it. And especially unkindness and prejudice and negative views of other people and other nations can be addictive. We are often addicted to our pet hatreds. We don't know quite what we'd do without them. And they help, we're dependent on them too, in that they help us to define our sense of self. They are everything that we think we are not. And so, as Alcoholics Anonymous found, to wean ourselves from this is a long process. Don't think you're going to start at step one and perfect that and then move on to step two. Because these things, you'll be struggling with them all your life. But it's the only way to live a truly moral life. As the charter says, the compassion lies at the heart of all our spiritual, moral, and ethical traditions. I think when we come to die, we can say that the world is perhaps a bit of a better and more compassionate place because we have lived in it. Then that life will have been worth living. And I think to keep that goal in mind, what will be your legacy? And make that a spur to action.
Wonderful. I think that is a great place for us to wrap up our conversation today. Karin, you truly are a global leader and pace setter in this compassion movement, and I'm guessing that this hasn't always been easy for you. So I just want to thank you on behalf of everyone who's been impacted by your work. Thank you for using your incredible intellect, your time, your talent, your voice to unite humanity through the transcendent power of compassion. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Emily.
And so for those of you listening, once again, if you'd like to learn more about Karin Armstrong's work and the wonderful work of the Charter for Compassion, if you'd like to start a cities campaign in your area, if you'd like to make a charitable contribution to the Charter for Compassion, please visit charterforcompassion.org. And again, because Karin's given her time for free today, I'd like to put in another request that you consider reading one of her books, such as The 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life. I appreciate that you've joined us today for this informative talk with Karin Armstrong, and I hope that you'll stay on the line and join us for our next session, where we will provide very practical ways that you can put compassion into action in your own life. We will kind of carry on the conversation that Karin and I have been having, and we'll move into some specific things that you can do related to compassion education, taking action in your life, and taking the advice of the many wonderful speakers we've had on the summit. So please join us for that last call. Thanks for joining us, everybody.
Thank you for joining us for the Summer of Peace, brought to you by the Shift Network. For more information about joining our global community dedicated to helping people awaken to their divine humanity and take inspired action, visit theshiftnetwork.com. To learn more about the Summer of Peace and the World Peace Library, visit summerofpeace.net. Thank you for sharing this summit with your friends and family. We appreciate your dedicated support.